Welcome to War Gaming Recon. I'm your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Today, we have yet another very special episode for you because we have a fan joining us. It's been a long time since they've been on the show, but there's something really cool, new, and exciting that has just released, and we think you should hear all about it. So, we have the one, the only, the very talented, and may I add, best-selling author of the Wargaming Campaigns and the Wargaming Compendium, the one and only Mr. Henry High joining us today. Henry, how are you today?
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for that intro. I am good. Thank you. As we were saying just for the show, the weather here in the UK is unusual at the moment. I'm in a t-shirt up here in my Luftwaffe studio. And that doesn't normally happen. But yeah, we've had some really crazy hot weather here in the UK, thanks probably to global warming. Obviously, that's potentially controversial, so we'll leave it there. But let's just say it's been incredibly hot. Fortunately, this week, not as hot as it was the previous week, where it hit like 40 degrees centigrade here, which is just unheard of. So, but I'm absolutely fine, Jonathan. Thank you for asking.
No, I can't remember the last time you were on, but it's easily been 2 years, I think.
Yeah, it must be. It's probably two, maybe even close to three, Jonathan, because I've had quite an exciting time. As the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times. And my last couple of years has been absolutely fascinating. So it's certainly been a couple of years or more, Jonathan. Yeah.
Oh, what many people tend to forget is that's a curse.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't forget, that's for sure. Now, I'll keep it brief. No need to go into too much detail, but I survived, thank goodness. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here otherwise. I survived prostate cancer, a mental breakdown, and COVID. So I've had the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, one of them was more than enough for anyone. But you got all of them. Jeez, man, that's awful.
Yeah, it's been, as I say, it's been interesting. And let's just say at this time now, like 18 months on from when it happened, you know, I know a great deal more psychology than I did before I had my breakdown, because I'm one of those guys that, you know, when something happens to me, I want to find out about why did that happen? How did that happen? You know, I thought I was a normal, sane, kind of completely together, cool kind of guy, and some things happened that I won't go into, and I sort of fell apart, and it's like, wow, that was a bit of a surprise. So I just started reading voraciously, and got therapy, which I would recommend to anyone who's going through struggles with their mental health. Got proper therapy, I've now finished having kind of long-term therapy, and my therapist said to me, Henry, consider taking a psychology degree, which I'll take as a compliment, because she just couldn't believe how much reading I was doing.
That is a compliment.
Because in you might know, Jonathan, but in psychotherapy, they call it doing the work. Yes. And too many people go to the sessions and think that going to the session, that's the work. No. It's the homework that you do in between those sessions that really makes the difference. And at the end, it was great. I was just going along to my sessions with my wonderful lady therapist, discussing the latest book that I'd read about certain, you know, codependency, transactional analysis, rational emotive behavior therapy, or whatever it happened to be. And she was like, wow, I haven't read that one. So she said, I think you can move on now, Henry. I think you're ready to move on, my friend. I don't think you need me more. So, you know, that was a compliment, and it was great. Kind of sad, because you build up, anyone who's had therapy knows you actually build up quite an intimate relationship with your therapist. But of course, one of the strange things is they're not actually allowed to be your friend. You know, that's in their professional remit, you know. So you can love them to death, but, you know, bye-bye, that's it. You can't say, oh, do you fancy coming out for coffee tomorrow? They're not allowed to do that. Absolutely. Anyway, so that was kind of exciting. And yeah, the COVID, fortunately, I had one of the milder variants, thank goodness, but it put me out of action for a while. But yeah, so there was those, the Holy Trinity. And then I know there's something else I'm forgetting. Oh, something to do with a book. I think there might have been a book that I finally managed to finish, not just writing, but designing and illustrating and all that kind of stuff as well. Yeah, that finally came out. And maybe we'll just kind of mention that in passing today, Jonathan.
So I think you are kind of like a unicorn among authors, in that not only do you write the darn thing.
Yeah.
You go through all of it. You design it. You lay it out. You promote it. And you do everything, really. And I'm sure that is more, there are more authors who do that, but you don't hear about it. And yeah. So it feels like you're this mythical, I don't know, chimera sort of thing that just kind of goes and does all these things. And it is really, it's been eye-opening for me just to see what you share about your journey with all of this sort of stuff and how much, I don't think anyone realizes how much work you put into it. The finished product shows just how wonderful it is.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. The first one, the Wargaming Compendium took me about 4 or 5 years to put together. This one took me, because of, you know, the troubles I've had, took me about 8 or 9 years to put together a single book. So most people will go, what? That's crazy. Because most authors, as you say, you know, well, it takes them a year to write the book and then, you know, another year to do all the final edits and all that. So let's just say 18 months to 2 years for a normal kind of book. Obviously, some authors are very prolific. You know, think of the Terry Pratchett's of this world or the Stephen King's or whatever, who are capable of churning out stuff faster than that. But let's just say a year to 18 months is fairly standard. In my case, it was like 8 years. But yes, I am technically what in the, you don't hear the term very much these days, but in the old days, I would be what's called an auteur, which is someone who's not just the author of a book. So think of it as a French word, auteur, A-U-R, I think, auteur. So it's not just the author, the person who writes the book, but also, yes, the person who does all the design and layout, that's for sure, illustration where necessary. And this book is packed full of, you know, maps I've drawn, photos I've taken, that kind of stuff, diagrams I've had to do. But that has been took a long time this time, because also I did something I've never done before, which is I put together a team of beta readers. Right. So again, for people who don't know, a beta readers are when an author is writing a book and say if it was a history book and you want to get your facts checked or something of that kind, or if it was a novel and you just wanted to know, frankly, whether it was crap or not, Jonathan, you know, and you send it out to a bunch of people who give you very honest feedback about, oh God, you know, I think, no, that character in chapter one, no, it doesn't work for me. The dialogue in chapter six, you know, it doesn't. Yeah. So it was very, very scary. This was probably, goodness me, I think it was before I had the cancer. So it's probably about 3 years ago I actually put the book out. So I had a team of a dozen beta readers. And they're all acknowledged in the book. They're people who, many of whom are kind of big name luminaries in the hobby themselves, or certainly written stuff, done magazine articles. Because I wanted the book to be given really brutal, honest feedback from people I respected. You know, it's no good just sending it out to people who are, you know, oh, I quite like it. No, I asked them to write a full report. I actually sent them a questionnaire saying, what do you think of this, what do you think of that, and so I gave them like 3 months to do that, and boy did they come back with some feedback.
And
fortunately 95% of it was really positive feedback. Oh, Henry, you know, this is terrific, hobbies needed this, but you know. And then there was like 5% which was like, well, some of it was astonishing. I think it was Nick Skinner of Two Fat Lardies, who's one of the beta, and he said, oh Henry, so it looks like you've forgotten to send us a chapter here. Where's the chapter about air warfare? And I was like, oh, hang on a minute, I'm sure I did something about it. I completely missed out an entire chapter that I had intended to write when I wrote out the original structure of the book. And Nick was the only one who spotted that. Well, hang on, you do all this other stuff, Henry, where's the chapter on air power? And I was like, oh my God. So I suddenly realized, having thought I'd finished the book, no, I've got a whole other chapter to write still. So that was kind of a big eye-opener. There was another guy who kind of specializes in naval warfare. He came back with some really good, powerful feedback about that. He said, well, it's all right as it goes, Henry, but to be honest, people, anyone who's kind of used to doing naval gaming or campaign is going to go, it's a bit meh. So I think you ought to reconsider this, that, or the other. That was hard to hear, obviously, because it was like, oh, I thought that chapter was okay. But he was saying, like, no, to be honest, there's going to be people who, you know what people who review books on Amazon are like, or Goodreads, they're going to say, oh, they'll pick out the bit that they hate the most, right? And they're going to, oh, well, that chapter on sea warfare was absolutely... So I end up pretty much completely rewriting that chapter. And then there was just some other bits and pieces. I mean, Beta readers are lovely people, but they also, of course, they have their own favorite bits, right? Yep. And so, you know, I got some feedback. Oh, Henry, I wish you'd said more about this or that or the other. It's like, well, that's just because you're mad about that particular bit of history or that kind of wargaming or whatever. And, you know, if I could have ranted on for pages about that. But to be honest, all it needed was mentioning in passing, if you're honest with me, right? Mm-hmm. So, but it was all really good because it made me really think very hard about, okay, does that deserve to stay in the book or should I cut it? And this, should it stay in the book or do I need more? Does it need less? So that was fantastic feedback. Then the cancer happened and that was like, boof. Then the mental breakdown happened and that was, so we're talking about, you know, I'd got to kind of mid 2021. And I was feeling well enough again to think, oh, do you know what? This book has just become like a millstone around my neck for all these years. I just want it finished. I want it out the door, off my Mac, you know, looking forward to that magic moment where you actually press send, you know. And so there was a bit that I'd, a whole chapter I'd written that was all about some real life campaigns. So I'll write a chapter, just giving some examples of real life campaigns. And that chapter alone had really started to grow way out of proportion because I realized, if do it justice, some of the beta readers said, oh, this chapter needs a bit more of this and that. And God, it was already like over 100 pages long for a single chapter. Mm-hmm. And the book now was looking like it was going to be like not, because it's ended up being 526 pages, something like that. It was going to be 100 pages more than that, at least. So I rang up my my guy at the publisher and said, Phil, can we have a chat? And I said, look, you know, there is this chapter, but if I can see what the beta readers mean and it might be important. But if I do knuckle down and do what I feel needs to be done to this chapter, it'll probably add yet another 50 pages and probably take me yet another few months. I said, I'd like your permission to cut the chapter. And he said, yeah, fine.
Nice.
Right, so there was me expecting, anticipating all this resistance. No, Henry, you promised it to the readers. The fact is, the readers didn't know there was going to be this extra chapter in there. So, like, who was I disappointing? Just my beta readers and me. So, just like that, it was like, oh, okay. So, I think I finished writing the book then, Phil. Oh, great. What about all the diagrams and illustrations? Yeah. Now that what I'd done as I was writing the book, I'd gone through. And, oh, yeah, insert diagram X here. Oh, insert map of Y here. You know. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to the manuscript, having been convinced that, oh, well, I've got a folder with all these things in. No, I hadn't.
Oh, no.
Purely in my imagination. So the last few months was me frantically finishing off all those maps and things that I'd thought in my head that I'd done. But, you know, a mental breakdown to do this to you, Jonathan, you'll start imagining things that you've done which you haven't. And so, yeah, it was pretty frantic. And then the last gasp was literally over the Christmas break, last Christmas, where because COVID was still around, we'd make plans with friends, family, that kind of stuff, and they all had to be called off because of, you know, lockdown restrictions and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, right. So suddenly I had a load of time on my hand. So I said, Henry, put your backside in the chair, finish the book. So I did. In a space of about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, I just got it done. Wow. So it was like mid, late January. I rang up my guy and I said, oh, Phil, who should I send the manuscript to? It's finished. And there was like silence at the end of the line. He said, you what? I said, yeah, it's finished. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, he said, quick, right, don't change your mind, don't fiddle with anything, send it to this guy, to that guy. So off it went to the proofreaders and stuff. And yes, that was kind of, I suppose it was the middle of February, wasn't it, that they finally said, right, we've pressed the button and it's headed off to India to be printed, because that's where it was. Mm-hmm. And then it was in the lap of the gods. It was how quick could the printers print it and how soon would the actual hard copies arrive back in a container ship, come all the way back through the Suez Canal and what have you, where you might remember there have been a few problems in the Suez Canal not long before. And in fact, it ended up arriving back here slightly early. So it was actually published about a month before I thought it was. And I've got to say, being an author these days is mad because your publishers tell you nothing, John, nothing. And they suddenly announce, oh, it's on sale. What? And there was me having said, oh, I'll do a website to accompany the book. So I hadn't finished the website to accompany the book. So I'm still finishing that off. But yep. Basically, yeah, June 8th, I think it was. There it was. It was on sale, Pen and Sword. And as you would have seen on Twitter, Jonathan, it's been amazing. People have been taking pictures of the book as it arrives on their doorstep, you know, and mm-hmm. they take it out of the packet, take a picture of it and post it on Twitter. It's here. My copy's here, which is like, this is fantastic, right? Any author would kill for that kind of publicity.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been quite a journey, Jonathan, and it was all a bit frantic at the end. But that's the nature of huge projects, that it kind of ticks along and has its ups and downs. And then, you know, life intervened. And then literally the last few months of it, it was just mad. I mean, I just threw myself at getting the thing finished. And thank goodness I did, because, yeah, that sense of relief when I actually hit send and the manuscript went off to the publishers, now out of my hands, guys. Anything that happens now is not my fault. So I am not delaying it. Yeah, and it's been amazing. I mean, it's interestingly, Pen and Sword didn't seem to get consignment to Amazon at the same time as they started selling it. It came late to Amazon, even here in the UK. I know that they stagger the sales. They release it in the UK, then it'll be over with you in the States in due course. I think they're now saying 1st of September, something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, I've heard end of August, early September. Yeah.
But what's been amazing is there's been a number of American readers who've been so impatient that they've ordered from the UK and had it posted to them. And knowing what postage rates are like now between the UK and the US, it's like, wow, that's amazing. That's dedication way beyond the call of duty. So it's been, you know, there are some guys over in the Canada and the States who've been posting their pictures. Oh yeah, no, I've got my copy, you know, while others are still waiting. So it's been amazing. It hit pretty much instantly on Pen and Sword's own website. It hit their number one bestseller spot pretty much overnight and stayed there for like 3 or 4 weeks, and it's still in the top 10. I think it was number 6 today. On Amazon, this has been wacky, because obviously with no sales on Amazon immediately, it didn't kind of hit the charts, you know, in quite the way I'd hoped, to be honest. But still, it got into their top 20 or something, top 15 or something in War Games and Role Playing here in the UK.
That's the most good.
Oh mate, I'm not complaining, and that's considering that they're not even selling it as much of a discount as Pen and Sword are themselves. This is all, you know,
book now selling. That's wacky.
Oh yeah, book selling politics, Jonathan, is like I say, they tell the author nothing. I've noticed. But the amazing thing was it hit number one in Sweden of all. Seriously, yeah. Someone, I think, posted on Twitter. Oh, yeah, your book. I got my book here in Sweden. I thought, I didn't even realize it was on sale in Sweden. I went and had a look on Amazon SE. Sweden.
Yeah,
it was at number one in role playing or War Games and Role Playing. Like, so quick, get a screenshot of that. So I got my bestseller tag after all.
Oh, that's too funny.
Sweden. What can I say? I don't know how many war games there are in Sweden, but enough to, you know, make that.
Yeah, there's deal. Enough.
Bless them. Bless their hearts, all three of them, whatever it is, you know. Fantastic. So, yeah, it's been kind of exciting. So now, yeah, here I am talking to you about it, and it's I'm frantically behind the scenes trying to get the website for the book finished with all those things in the book as I was going on, a bit like where I'd said insert diagram here. I'd put, oh, yes, to download this from the site accompanying the book. And, of course, by the time I actually finished the book, I'd completely forgotten how much I'd promised to do.
Isn't that always the way?
So, yeah, work still to do. Unpaid work, I should say, for that. But there we go. That's the life of a traditionally published author. There we are. I'll shut up. You can ask me some questions.
Well, so I think you gave a really good overview of the life of the book, as it were. But why don't we kind of dive into a little more detail? So let's kind of pretend we're playing with timey-wimey and we're going back in the nice big blue... telephone booth, and gonna ask why write it at all, right? So you wrote the Wargaming Compendium. I and others of my generation feel that that's probably the definitive wargaming book of our generation, right? And there's been other wargaming books out there that deal with campaigns or have sections on them. Of course, you can go back to Featherstone, Wargame Campaigns, the Wargame by Charles Grant, Solo Wargaming Guide. Your Wargaming Compendium has a whole section in there about map making, clearly intended for campaign use. And other authors, Wesencraft and so forth, have had stuff that's kind of danced around the topic.
Tony Barth. Got to mention Tony Barth in there, setting up a Wargaming campaign.
So why jump into the lake? Why do a Wargaming campaign book?
Because for me, it was the logical next step. Because I'd done that kind of chapter in the compendium, as you kindly mentioned, that was kind of an introduction to campaign. And I did supply, didn't I? There was a set of campaign rules in there that was the campaign rules based on what I'd originally done my Wars of the Faltinian Succession with, you know, kind of horse and musket eras. And it was all very well received. But I mean, there was a couple of things. First of all, I got so many questions. Oh, God, if I had a pound or a dollar even for, because they're worth much the same these days.
Unfortunately.
For how many times in the intervening, oh my God, how many years has it been? Quite a few years. Then people have said to me, oh, so Henry, how do you actually make your maps? How do you do your maps, Henry? Show us a video how you make your map. And it's like, and what software do you use to make your maps, Henry? Like, there's some kind of magic bullet software that, oh yeah, you just say, I want two opposing 18th century countries, press this button, ding, and there's your campaign map, right?
There's not.
Well, so I thought, well, that alone deserves, you know, a chunk of attention. I've massively expanded what I've written about how I make maps. People are asking, well, how I make maps is I start with a pencil sketch, seriously, on a piece of paper, just an outline and a few ideas. And then I scan that into Adobe Photoshop and I start work, you know, and I might use a combination of Adobe Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator. But that's where I go. And yes, some of the files I create are vast. You know, you need a high power, by the way, intervening years. And there have been a number of pieces of software that have appeared, including software that you don't even have to download. You can just do it all online. Mm-hmm. That are mostly geared towards doing fantasy maps, that kind of stuff. But that, you know, the whole fantasy role-playing world has expanded so much and continues to expand. And people are meeting the needs of that crowd. So there's an incredible software out there that almost is, you know, press a button and here's a country. How mountainous do you want it to be? How many rivers do you want it to have? What do you want the weather to be like? You know, and how many cities and blah, 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 blah. Some of it is astonishing. So I took the opportunity to list all those bits of software that I found in the book. And obviously, if people buy the ebook version, they get live links to it. But also, if you buy the hard copy, some information I have already actually put on the website for the book is those links live to those bits of software. And there was about a dozen or 15, I think I found, most of which are like, wow, yeah, for the vast majority of people, they might say, do you know what, Henry, that'll do me just fine. And if you're happy with that, and you don't fancy doing the whole kind of Photoshop artistry thing, that's cool, you know, and that's brilliant. But it did give me the opportunity to show people how I actually do a map literally from the ground up. And I used the example of a campaign that I designed as part of my mad 18th century world, a kind of a periphery to the Wars of the Faltine Succession, which was, there was a guy called, that was, there is a wonderful guy called Simon Tonkis, called Goat Major online. And he's a really lovely guy. And a few years ago, when I was running kind of Wars of the Faltinian Succession campaigns and doing the big games at Ayton in North Yorkshire that a load of people came to me, had huge games over the weekend. He's a guy who kind of asked me, oh, you know, Henry, I'd quite like to, you know, would you let me play some of your Prunkland forces, you know, which is my baby Prunkland.
Yep.
And I had to think about it. I thought, yeah, okay, why not? I said, you know, if you give it a bit of a twist, that would be good. He said, well, what about kind of like Prunkland's version of the Foreign Legion? You know, so it's like, or the East India Company, something like that, where you've got So they serve Prunkland, but they're not necessarily resident in Prunkland. They serve kind of over in the colonies and that. And oh wow, okay, that's a really interesting angle. Great, damn, that means I need to invent some colonies, doesn't it? So what happened was, it's like, you know, I went, okay, what should I do? And I chatted with him a bit, and he said, well, what if it's a bit like the Indian subcontinent, that kind of thing? So I came up with this idea of this what turned out to be vast subcontinent of Dalia and Chindrastan. So kind of a bit like Pakistan and India, that sort of vibe, you know. So they're similar but different religiously and culturally and that kind of stuff. So and I think I must have made a mistake when I was drawing up the scale on the map, because this thing is like 2,000 miles by 1,000 miles.
You know? My goodness.
It is enormous, absolutely enormous. Obviously, in real life, you know, India and Pakistan are enormous. But I'd kind of, in my head, I thought, you know, kind of a version of India and Pakistan, but it ended up being enormous. So that's what you get in the book. You get this massive, in-depth, right, this is starting just from the outline and adding the various topographical layers in contours and the rivers and the lakes and the cities and everything. And in fact, it was growing like topsy. And in fact, this was a couple of years ago in the middle of doing this. I realized I was running out of ideas for place names, you know, because they all needed to sound kind of vaguely or whatever, you know. So I put a call out on Twitter and said, look, anyone who wants to get their name in the book, make some name suggestions, and I promise I'll, in the acknowledgements, I'll mention. So I have, you know, in the first page of the book, there's this list of, I don't know, quite like 100 or so or more people, 150 people, all of whom contributed anything from one place name up to some people submitted dozens. Some of them also, I have to say, were too rude to be included. but that's people on Twitter for you. But yeah, so this vast array of names, most of which have now been used, because the continent is just vast, and it ranges from kind of junglish areas to deserty areas to mountain areas and what have you, vast coastline with lots of crinkly bits in. So it was great fun making it, and it was the ideal thing to show people, you know, if you really want to see how I make my maps, this is how I make my maps, you know. Right from the, as I say, the early beginnings of a pencil sketch right through to the final version, which looks like a couple of pages out of an atlas. So yeah, people got the full Monty, but I also showed more, you know, imaginative ideas about how to do much smaller maps, perhaps even taking a real place, taking its outline, flipping it or turning it upside down or whatever, or taking a cold place, making it a hot place, all those kind of things. I took one example where I've taken a map of Europe and like pulled it apart like a jigsaw and just put it back together randomly to make this Europia or somewhere, I think I called it, this jumbled map. And it's what's fascinating is how long it takes people to realize, hang on a minute, is that Italy in the middle there upside down and flipped the other way over? You know, it's like, yes, well done. And
that's
then
nice.
People, you know, it kind of fits together. So the maps thing, Jonathan, obviously that's kind of a big reason why I decided I needed to do more about them. But then once you start thinking about that, it's like, well, okay, there's so many aspects of campaigning, like the rule set I included compendium. It was pretty comprehensive. But then when you think, well, if it's a book about campaigns, it should be even more comprehensive, you know. Why not let loose my inner demon and start including all the stuff about the weather, about supplies, about, well, what about adding naval? So here we are focusing on land warfare. What effect would it be if people might not want to do a standalone naval campaign, but they certainly want to be able to kind of do amphibious landings or show what would happen, how naval disrupt what's going on land or support what's going on land? What about the supply situation? What about weird and wacky random events, like you're in the middle of a war and your king dies? What do? You know, who takes over? How do you decide that? What if your army is composed mostly of mercenaries and it turns out they haven't been paid for a month and they decide, right, we're going to down tools. So I came up with ideas, many of which bluntly stolen from elsewhere, of, you know, a set of campaign cards that literally each campaign move, you draw a card for each player and they have to abide by whatever's on the campaign card, for ill or for good. So they might get a supply of new boots, which means, oh, they can march a bit faster. Or conversely, they might have gone a week without water, which means that they're slowing down. Sudden storms, tempests, snow, blitz, whatever. Then the weather, the effects of weather on... One of the things in wargaming, you'll know this, which so often just gets... not just neglected, it gets completely ignored, right? How many times have you done a set down tabletop battle where the weather hasn't even been considered? It's been a nice, flat, open plain, nice sunny day, a gentle breeze, you know, no...
It's almost comical.
Absolutely. So it's like, well, hang on a minute. Okay, if that's what you want to do for your one-off battle, fair enough. But campaigns, what is it that's different, John? And one of the things is that this stuff should matter. So not only should the effect of the battle you're fighting now have an effect on the next battle and the battle after that in terms of casualty supplies and so on and so forth, but also it should matter what's happening with the weather, where you might, you know, if you have one nice sunny day, you're fine. If you have a whole week of sunny days and no rain, that can start to have an effect. Actually, suddenly it's not quite so pleasant anymore. If you have a whole month with no rain, this is now serious. In this, by the same token, obviously, if it rains a bit for a day, drizzles a bit, not a problem. If it doesn't stop raining for a month, you're in trouble. Your rivers, you can't cross. Snow, ice, gale force winds, thunderstorms. And so it was, you know, many of us who do kind of ancient or horse and musket wargaming can pretty much kind of make a stab. All right, yeah, it probably have that kind of effect. What about modern warfare? What about sci-fi or fantasy, you know? And so I end up drawing up a pretty comprehensive list of potential effects of the weather on campaigns, not just the battles, but what's happening between the battles. Because obviously, think of Napoleon Waterloo, he couldn't fire his cannon for, you know, several hours till the ground had dried out. The supplies getting to the troops in the front bogged down. Think of the, you know, the Russian winters in, you know, the German army experienced in the 1940s. Wow, you know, it was great when they were zooming in hot, sunny Russian summer. As soon as it starts raining, hundreds and hundreds of miles just become a quagmire, you know. Vehicles, even track vehicles, getting bogged down. How do you cope with that? What does it do? Air power. I mentioned air power. What effect does weather have on air power? Well, obviously, if you can't see the ground in a pre-modern era before you got laser-guided missiles and whatnot, you're in trouble. Think of all the bombs that the Germans dropped on the wrong places, or that the British and Allies dropped on the wrong places during World War II, because actually the bomb aimers couldn't really see the target, okay? Just because of a bit of cloud. All that kind of thing starts to make a difference in a real way when it's... Whereas if it's a one-off, you know, game, most people would say, well, if the weather's really bad, I'm just going to... we're not going to play, right? Yep. So this is where the value of campaigns comes in, where you as a player are sometimes forced to fight a battle in a place you might not want to fight it, at a time you might not want to fight it, in a time of year you might not want to fight it, weather you might not want to fight it, even not with the troops you want to fight it with. Because they're stuck in the mud somewhere back there, so you've only got your militia here. Think of the War of Independence, you know, your American Revolution, and the number of times that, oh, hey, crikey, oh, damn, we've only got a battalion of militia. What are we going to do? Answer often, run away. But sometimes if it's really important, oh, God, you know, will their morale hold? It forces you as a player to really kind of take on situations that you might not, or probably likely you wouldn't if it was just a normal set down game on a Friday night at the club or whatever, right? And that's the thrill of campaigning, isn't it? It's that whole extra dimension. And it doesn't matter whether it's a historical campaign set in the ancient period or the horse and musket period or World War II, it equally applies to science fiction or fantasy. You know, we can't always assume that everything's going to be hunky-dory at the moment where we want to fight that battle, you know. And it also, the great thing that makes it, it's so much fun being a commander in a campaign, because you get to really use strategy. You might not be the most brilliant tactician on the battlefield, but if you understand strategy, you can beat the enemy. You know, there have been so many occasions in history where you might say, you know, well, Robert E. Lee, for example, was an amazing general. Confederacy lost the war, right? It's one of those things that individual brilliance on the battlefield doesn't necessarily win the war for you, doesn't necessarily win the, and that's you true. Can bring in, you can bring in as many factors as you like. I'm already having queries, right? Because I do my Patreon, I've got the Q&As, and already obviously people have obviously bought the books. Henry, I want to know more about the 18th century economy. What do these people think I am? You know, it's like, hang on a minute. This is true. If people want to use economic fact, you know, into exchange rate fact, global supply factors, any number of things, politics that's going on behind the scenes. I mean, that's a very common thing, isn't it? Where you get bickering between generals, or you get bickering in the ruling party. And so, you know, look at what happened to Russia during the First World War. They had a revolution back home. That's going to impair your ability to fight a war. Sure.
True.
Any number of occasions where you think that the general's literally there on the battlefield. Yeah, that's the sharp end of the war, but the number of things that can happen back home that are beyond your control. The Duke of Marlborough, anyone who's familiar with the campaigns of the amazing Duke of Marlborough, the early 18th century, he was completely, had his hands tied behind his back because of, you know, the British government had this alliance with the Dutch, and the Dutch had a lot of the money, and if the Dutch didn't want something to be done, it didn't happen. Or if the Dutch did want something to be done, oh, okay, I suppose we better do that then. Keeping your allies happy, you know, and particularly if they've got deep pockets. And the poor Duke of Marlborough was pulling his hair out so much of the time. He could see, if only I could attack that city now, this would all be over. But they say, oh, not sure about that. No, I think we'll wait on that one. Let's see what happens over here. And he's like, no, this is the moment. No, let's have a think about that first. So all that kind of stuff, of course, can be brought in to your wargaming campaigning, and it could be great fun. Now, I'm going to stop, pause, go back a bit, because right at the beginning of the book, Jonathan, one of the things I talk about is why is it so many people either don't fight wargame campaigns at all, or have tried it and it goes completely wrong, and they give up. Right, I've heard so many stories. Oh, yeah, we tried doing it, got boring. And two of the players didn't seem that interested in doing as much paperwork as the other players. And, you know, the umpire got the ump with them and it all fell apart. And had three games and that was it. Yes, that can happen. And so much of it comes down to the personality and the ability of the games master, umpire, call them what you will, the person who's running the game. Because usually you do have an umpire in a campaign. You don't have to, and I write about that. But what's absolutely crucial to anyone listening, if you're going to get involved in a campaign or you're thinking of running a campaign, you've got to make sure all your players are on board to the same, if not precisely the same, at least to a similar, because there's nothing more frustrating than you as umpire. Oh, wow, yes, I've come up with this idea, a problem for them to solve. And you put in loads of work and send this thing out. Say you've got 10 players and you only get 3 replies. What do you do, right? And that can be not just incredibly frustrating and annoying, but it can just be the death of the campaign. Because it's like, well, if only 3 players are actually pulling their weight and responding to, you know, the input that I'm asking them to give, you know, it can be something as simple as, where are your troops this week? Well, if only 3 of them answer, what's the umpire supposed to do? So the umpire can randomly decide, right, because you horrible people, didn't answer me, I'm just going to randomly say, right, well, they marched off in the wrong direction or whatever, you know. Let's say that can lead to some disagreements.
Yeah.
Okay. If you've got, say, 9 or 8 or 9 players out of the 10 who do respond and 1 or 2 who don't, you can pretty much fudge that as umpire. You can, oh, okay, I'll let them off this time, send them a private stern warning. Don't do that again, right? or get a the cat died, whatever. They might have a perfectly legitimate, and they may just be, oh God, you know, I had to work 18 hour days that week, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But setting up your campaign to make sure that everyone is on board far as possible, the same extent, that's the only way you're going to get a campaign before you do anything else. It's almost like the rules for the campaign don't matter. You know, as an umpire, you can make stuff up like a dungeon master can. You can just make stuff up on the hoof if all your players are invested in what you're doing. But if they're not all invested, a huge amount of work and from the discipline for pretty much everyone. So, yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
No, it's just, I was going to say, actually, what you're describing is pretty common for people who do role-playing games. They have what they call a session zero, where they talk about everything. They'll talk about what kind of campaign they like to play, what kind of games they like to play, what kind of characters. Yeah. Insofar, they even kind of dive into, you know, what are trigger warnings for them, what's okay to or to not do in the campaign, or in the game, and how frequently, all that logistical kind of stuff. But a thing that kind of really stands out for me with it is, often I know they'll talk about what they really like, what some of their favorite parts of gaming are. Do they want something that's more narrative? Do they want something that's more action? And of course there's a crossover into wargaming campaigns, but it makes me actually kind of wonder, as you were writing the book, what's your one favorite part of it?
Oh my goodness.
Was one part easier than the others to do, or bring you a little more joy, or
I love doing the map stuff. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. I actually really enjoyed the chapter about strategy. Writing about, well, help, because as I was saying, there's kind of a lot of players could be quite good at tacticians in a normal game, but as soon as you give them not just a few battalions to work with but a few divisions, right? There's hills and mountains and rivers, and I don't know what I'm doing. And no idea. How do I coordinate getting this division to meet up with that division to make it so it would overwhelm that enemy division? A lot of people fall to pieces. So I really enjoyed putting together the chapter on strategy, because what I did was I kind of did a questionnaire, and I asked a series of questions, many questions about, you know, well, okay, where do we need to get to? How are we going to get there? How long is it? If we get there, can we get back again if something goes wrong? You know, what might prevent us from getting there? What might prevent us from getting back? Should I commit everything? Should I just only commit part of it? All these basic questions that, once you practice them a few times, become sort of second nature, but they do need to be practiced. And that was, I really enjoyed writing that chapter because it was hard. I really had to think hard about what questions should you ask to enable someone to come up with a picture to help them understand what strategy they should adopt in a particular situation. And then I also did an example from the Wars of the Faltine Succession about, all right, so that this is a practical example of someone who has had to ask those and answer those questions. And I think that's a chapter that I think a lot of people are going to find help. There's also stuff I wrote about my own Wars of the Faltine Succession. I actually have a chapter that's based on some magazine articles that I did when I was editor of Miniature War Games Battle Games. A particular set of circumstances around, it was the country of Borgenmark, I think, where I'd done a whole load of brand new map making for that, and we had some really good map maneuvering going on, and there were some funny incidents, and I'd kept kind of a newsletter blog and stuff, a lot of really good personalities involved, and it ended up with a weekend of massive game, hugely impressive. That was good fun. I think when you're talking about a project as big as that, Jonathan, it is hard to pick out chunks that are kind of your favorite, because the whole thing is like this giant baby.
Yes, it is.
It was nearly too big to be born, you know. And I think, however, I'm just kind of proud that I managed to do it, particularly given the circumstances, underfinished.
Absolutely.
And that it kind of hangs together, and that it is comprehensive. I mean, it's interesting when you start seeing reviews of your own book, it's kind of weird. You have to sort of detach yourself from it. And there was someone, a guy, I think, either an American or a Canadian guy, actually did a YouTube video review of the book. And it was kind of weird because the stuff he was picking up on, I was thinking, why is he focused on that? Mm-hmm. And it was almost like at parts, it's like, the way he was describing my book didn't sound like the book I'd written. It's so strange when other people latch onto certain things about the book that you would never have imagined that someone would latch onto. You know, for example, he commented about the fact that, oh gosh, I'm not sure about this. He's used Wikipedia as a reference in his footnote. And it's like, well, yes, of course I have, because not everyone has a copy of Encyclopedia on their shelf at home, but anyone nowadays can access Wikipedia. And also, don't knock Wikipedia. Wikipedia is actually now an extraordinary reference source, particularly for the kind of military history and stuff that we generally deal with, or stuff about generating weather charts like I did. It's like, why use Wikipedia? It's because I know that then anyone who wants to can go and check my facts, right?
Yeah.
So Wikipedia is the modern kind of Encyclopedia Britannica or whatever that everyone has access to. That's why I used it, but it didn't occur to this guy that he wanted me to almost to use more obscure reference stuff mm-hmm. that, I don't know, does he like spending hundreds of pounds on a volume of this, that, or the other? I don't know. But that was kind of weird. It was obviously a very brief initial read through that it just was kind of flipping the pages. And it was like, there's so much in there. Read, there's like 250,000 words in this book, Jonathan. And it's like how someone can just give a first minute, you know, flick through just off the boat kind of thing. But that's life as an author, mate. It's like, okay, thank you very much for reviewing my book. That's very kind of you. But it makes you wonder what if people are relying on online reviews before they go buy something, what kind mm-hmm. of impression has that given them, a true impression of what the book's about? Not so sure about that. But anyway...
So it's funny you mention it because I really, obviously I've never written a book, but I really sympathize with it for two reasons. One, because as a content creator, I'm in the middle of it, right? So something comes out and we talk about it. And that's why in general, I've made a conscious decision to not refer to something as a review if it is a more casual approach to it. Yeah. It'll be like, here's our response, or we're going to chat about it or look at it, something like that. Whereas if it's an actual review, it's more in depth, and we have actual criteria that we use here on the show for it, where we kind of like have an internal rating system and how we go and look at this, look at that, or so forth.
Yeah.
But then also, as a content creator, people respond and react to things that we put out. And so there's been unexpected reactions, good, bad, or the other. You talked earlier this episode about mental health, and that's something that we try to really normalize. We've been doing that for years, and the importance of it. And I've received really deeply heartfelt and impactful messages from people about what some of the content has done for them. Things that really I'm appreciative of, but also I hope that these individuals go and get help because it's clear that maybe it would be useful to them. But also like people will pick up on something, maybe like an offhand remark that I'll make. And I think nothing of it, right? It's just, it's something I'll say. And then someone takes it to heart. And usually it's something that I don't mean it this way, but it comes across and it ends up having a really negative reaction for them.
And then
I'll hear about it. I'll be like, oh, wait, no, I didn't intend that. I'm so sorry.
And because the other thing, Jonathan, because of it is now literally the World Wide Web, there's stuff going on out there that I'll never hear about.
Yeah.
You know, there may well be people who've talked about my book on their blog, but there's so many thousands of blogs and people on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and goodness knows where out there. Might just be seeing the tip of the iceberg, you know, and it's an extraordinary thing, as you say, when you're a creator and when you've spent, I've got a copy here. There it is. This thing, Jonathan, weighs 2 kilos or something. It's enormous. 528 pages. It took me, yeah, as I say, 8-9 years of my life to put together. And someone's little off-the-cuff remark that they make in like 2 seconds,
yep,
is as a summary of my book. It's like, seriously? Really, mate, you should try doing something like that yourself, you know, because, you know, but at the same time, as an author, you do have to kind of not be too precious about it, because what you've done is, and certainly in the modern day, you've created a product, and yeah, that's how it is then treated. You know, this was my baby, but to someone else, to Amazon, to my publishers, it's a product, right? Mm-hmm. What they want to see is how fast. True. And if I was being really ruthless about it, it's like, well, how soon am I going to earn back the advance that they gave me however many years ago it was, and actually see some royalties, you know, for, yes, this, right? This is, you know, between you, me, and the gatepost, no one's listening, are they, Jonathan? This is,
no, of course not. No one tunes into the show. It's just
absolutely this is the last book I'm ever going to have traditionally published, because mate, at 10% royalties for 9 years of work, I don't think so, right? And when you think, because earlier in the show I was mentioning the first people to discount the book was my publishers.
Yes.
It's got a £40 cover price, and suddenly I'm seeing they're selling it for like £28 or something. So immediately that's like a 40% cut in my income, mm-hmm, without telling me anything. They just did it.
It's right? Like the film studios and their interesting accounting practices.
Yeah.
So that, like how Lord of the Rings actually lost money when it came out, yeah, all three films. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 right. But it's true. It's like, so this thing immediately went on sale at a discount. Yeah. So I don't know how long it's going to be before I actually see any royalty, because obviously it's now going to take longer to repay the blooming advance that they gave me all those years ago.
Yeah.
So let's just put it this way, Jonathan. As with my first book, I haven't done this for the money. I've done it for the love. And, you know, what do I love about it? I just, you know, there's so much in it. I do, you know, I want to say public. There's a whole screed for I want to, you know, I've thanked in the book for helping me stuff, finding stuff, making suggestions. Obviously, the beta was not earlier. But I've got to say, Nick Skinner and Rich Clark of Two Fat Lardies, wow. They basically said to me, Henry, use whatever you'd like. You know, they've done some Discord campaigns. One of the things I talk about in the book is bringing campaigning up to date. So it's not all, I mean, now who sends things by post, right? And waits for 2 weeks before, oh, what, I wonder what moves he's made 2 weeks later. Oh, he's done that. You know, when I think back to my first campaigns with my mate Guy, that's what we were doing. But now, of course, everything's instantaneous. And they've been running campaigns I've seen online, using Discord, right? Mm-hmm. Discord chat room software and stuff. And the work they did on that, making completely fictitious maps, organizing the sides, dealing with, you know, rumors and intelligence and reconnaissance pictures. It's just incredible stuff. And they just let me use a load of it in the book. So, because I was saying, oh, you know, would it be all right if I used a couple of pictures? Oh, use whatever you want, Henry, just whatever you want. Absolutely amazing. And in the end, Nick Skinner ended up writing a whole section in one of the chapters, because it was like, well, I suppose I could try and write about Discord, but I actually haven't run a Discord campaign, mm-hmm, whereas Nick has. So Nick wrote about it. So it's straight from the horse's mouth, which is much more useful for the reader. But, you know, how do you thank guys, you know, for doing stuff like that? They literally just kind of opened their treasure chest doors to me and let me plunder their stuff. Absolutely amazing. Phenomenal support from within the hobby. And now, as I say, I'm incredibly grateful, because the support I'm getting from the people buying the book, particularly on Twitter, I have to say that the Twitter sphere for wargaming is amazing. Mm-hmm. And the support I've been getting there, well, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm just incredibly grateful.
Well, so now that the book is out in the UK and Sweden, apparently, to the US, what are you going to do next? I'm not asking what project you're going to do next, because clearly you need a break, I think. that's my own opinion. What are you going to do? Are you going to sit back and go for a nice long walk, or like, what's coming down the pipe for you?
For quite a while now, I've been focusing on what I mentioned, the psychology reading, mental health, that kind of stuff, making sure that I'm okay, and my physical health as well. I've been, you know, I still exercise every day, because I lost a shedload of weight. I lost Well, in British terms, I lost about 4 stones, which are 56 pounds, 60 pounds in weight, something like that.
Wow.
That obviously helped me a lot. And I'm trying to continue that.
Mm-hmm.
So looking after myself is number one priority. Number two, it's like I the weird thing is there I was sitting there writing books about wargaming campaigns. I did so little wargaming myself over the last couple of years. And in fact, the most recent stuff I've been doing is with a bunch of close friends. I've been dungeon mastering some Dungeons and Dragons stuff.
Oh, funny.
Which for me is extraordinary because the last time I did D&D was back in the early 1980s, in smoke-filled rooms with just a pencil and a piece of paper and a drug-addled DM, you know, no miniatures. Whereas now I've come back to D&D. I've had great fun because instead of worrying about painting 48-man battalions, mm-hmm. I can paint like a handful of figures and they look great. 3D printing, Jonathan, the stuff that's coming out of that world, not just in terms of your characters for the D&D, but NPCs and also, you know, all the scenic stuff, you know, market stalls and buckets full of fruit and veg and stuff, just the whole shebang. That's been really lovely for me because just focusing on a few bits and pieces on a small table has really freed me up to then really have fun with the role playing. You know, I've been doing little audio, like radio play things, putting on all kinds of voices because I'm a big fan of listening to fantasy audiobooks. There's a fantasy author called Joe Abercrombie who writes very grimdark stuff. The Blade itself, I think, was the first trilogy. Absolutely. And his narrator, a guy called Stephen Pacey, is one of those genius narrators who can put on 100 voices in quick succession and you couldn't tell it's all him. Absolutely incredible. So he's my role model. And I've been doing these little radio plays and stuff and newsletters about what's been going on in the dungeon campaign and. So that's been huge fun. I'm about to start writing for Wargame Soldiers and Strategy magazine again.
They've asked
me to because I took a break and understandably. And the guy at WSS for quite some time said, "Oh, Henry, would you come back? And we miss you. So I've kind of said, "Yeah, all right, but not the same as it was before." So I'm coming back and I'm going to be doing some more sort of campaign focus. I remember what it was called, How to Win at War Games, wasn't like that? Wasn't Tabletop Tactics?
I think something like that, yeah.
So this will be like Map Top Tactics or something. I don't know, strategy.
Awesome.
Something, you know, along those lines to be advised, as they say. I'm just about to sit down and write the first one. And beyond that, I'm getting back into my own hobby. The D&D has been a fabulous re-entry because it's also reminded me, Jonathan, how much I love the maps, how much I love the imagination stuff. And obviously I've got my two completely different, you know, imaginations things, you know, ready to pick up whenever I want. Really, I've got my Wars of the Faltinian Succession 18th century stuff, which is vast and unending. And I've got my the Bathalas Ancients campaign where I'd started putting together. I've done quite a few units, haven't I, of the Bizarbian, completely fictitious, ancient sort of Arabic-ish kind of nation. And they were tremendous fun. And I was getting great, you know, response, posting pictures as I was painting them, you know, on Twitter. So those are two things I'm definitely going to pick up again. And funnily enough, my regular Q&A for patrons is coming up and someone sent me a question. I don't want to say too much, but let's just say some swine has given me an idea for another way of approaching my imaginations, which is an appallingly good idea. And I hate him for it because, of course, that's another rabbit hole I can disappear down. So basically, John, that's going to be where I'm going next, is coming back to the things I love the most. Because that's what turns me on in the hobby, and certainly because I think initially I'll probably be doing quite a lot of soloing for the time being. I can quite happily spend entire days, you know, working out budget lists for Regiment von Eintopf's latest supply of uniforms or boots or whatever it is, and feel perfectly content with that without any pressure to feel like, oh, God, I've got to get another 10 battalions painted or another 5 squadrons in time for, you know, Saturday's game or whatever. I think, because I'm 61 now as well, Jonathan, you know, and I've I've been through a bit in the last couple of years, and it's you made really me realize, have. You know, it's made me realize that, I just finished reading the book all about this. I've been too much of a people pleaser.
Oh, you too, huh?
Yep. And there's a brilliant book called Please Yourself, which by a woman called Emma Turrell, which I highly read. And it's made me go, oh, yeah, that's me. That's me. Oh, dear. That's me. And so it's given me a bit of a wake-up call about how I, for most of my life, in fact, have been running around like the proverbial blue backsided fly, mm-hmm. Trying to get everything done for everyone else and neglecting me and what I want, really. So I'm just going to potter along quite happily. And if I get an idea for a big, ooh, ba-dang. And of course, I need to stay productive because, you know, the last couple of years of pandemic and cancer and all the rest of it has meant that my income has been a bit like jittery. So mm-hmm. I need to produce more stuff that more people will buy more often. And that is where my self-publishing really begins. And so I've already got something in the works, which I will be announcing in the hopefully not too. So folks, keep an eye on me on Twitter or whatever, where I'll be talking about what I've got in the works. All right.
That sounds good. So you mentioned Twitter, but how can people stay up to date with all the things that you're going to be doing in your journey of puttering around?
Right. Well, okay. I mean, I run a Patreon gig, so it's patreon.com/battlegames. I am at battlegames on Twitter. There's a facebook.com/battlegames. I've just started an Instagram account because I thought, hey, why not? So that is at battlegames_HH. I think that pretty much covers most things. And obviously, you know, go to Amazon if you want to find the books, or Pen and Sword's own website, and just, you know, Wargaming Campaigns or the Wargaming Compendium. Yeah, I'm all over the place, really, Jonathan.
You also, are.
What I'd love is for people to come and become patrons at, you know, patreon.com.
No, that sounds really good. Well, Henry, I want to thank you for taking this time to be with us here for this episode. It has been absolutely wonderful talking to you, and I'm so happy we were able to reconnect and just kind of chat.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for having me on, Jonathan. Really appreciate it.
And I just want to make sure to thank everyone for listening to this episode. Don't forget, check out all of Henry's socials. And of course, you can find us here on all the things as Wargaming Recon, whether it's knee deep in a little tiny corner of a campaign map or out on the interwebs. We are everywhere. Wargaming Recon, you can find us. And thank you all once again for taking the time to let us into your lives, to this episode, and just for your continued support here of the show. We talked a little bit in this episode about mental health, and all of you know about my own journey with that and grief and all the craziness that's been going on. But we have more great episodes coming to you. So if you're a new listener or a long time, you might know the way we end our episodes is crazy, just like the way we open them. So don't forget, no matter how busy you are, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter how many copies of the Wargaming Campaign you're going to buy for your friends and yourself and spend hours reading it, you know that you have to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon on your mobile device. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Thank you to everyone who backed our 2021 podcast season on Kickstarter. In particular, we'd like to thank 3DDZYN at 3ddesign.com, Nate Taylor of Dwarven Forge, and Things from the Basement, where you can get highly detailed laser cut terrain kits for 28, 20, and 15 millimeter figures and other exciting products. We couldn't have been successful without the help of all of you. Thank you so much for your support and being part of our community. We hope you are enjoying the 2021 season.